Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. Greetings and welcome back. As you probably know, as I indicated, today is our special 2 for 2 day, and we broadcasted this morning, Legal Beat in the Morning, so if you haven't had a chance to listen in, make sure you do so. But we are back this evening for a very special episode of In the Know. I am your host, Tony Reeves, and as always, it's a pleasure to have you on with me this evening. As always, I'm here to let you know that the show is proudly sponsored by the Reeves Law Firm, dedicated to representing the disabled and the discriminated, the Reeves Law Firm. Visit www.reevesfirm.com, or you can, of course, call toll-free anywhere in the country, 888-962-0007. Of course, for those of you who are tuning in this evening, if you want to call in, the number is 718-508-9431. Again, 718-508-9431. Chat lines are open, but if you have instant message, you can definitely hit me up at tony_reeves@hotmail.com. Again, tony_reeves@hotmail.com. And if you have a Yahoo, it's the_legalbee@yahoo.com. Again, the_legalbee, let's get my bearings right, at yahoo.com. Now, I'm going to tell you, I'm really looking forward to the discussion tonight from our guest and our author who will be with us very shortly, because the book she wrote, actually, it was funny because as I was reading her book, I was actually getting a slight, I was actually kind of re-reflecting on some of the things that I thought in terms of my thought process as it relates to various words and so forth. It's going to sound corny when I say some of the things that I'm saying, but it'll make all the sense in the word, because the title of her book is called Shift, Change Your Words, Change Your World. And I'll tell you a little bit more about the author as she comes on here, but it was interesting because as I was reading her book, I started laughing because I thought about the phrase that most of us hear when we're growing up as kids, sticks and stones may break my bones, words will never hurt me. But think about it like this. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but bones mend and bones can heal. But words can leave a lasting impression. Not only can words leave a lasting impression, words can leave a powerful impression in terms of how you perceive certain sets of facts, which is one of the things I glowingly got from, which of course was probably her design in terms of you can take a variety of different things from her book. But one of the things that I noticed is that she emphasizes the fact that words are very powerful in their ability to frame your mindset and how you view certain set of circumstances. Let me give you a good example. If you've got a car and you only got one car, and all of a sudden your transmission goes out, so you take it to two different auto mechanics. Well, one mechanic, and this is the thing, one mechanic may view your facts and present the information in these type of words. They may say, oh, man, you're going to need your transmission repair. Ooh, this thing's going to be really expensive. Yeah, this is probably going to be a killer for you. You're going to have to come out a lot of money for it. Now, come on now. Most of us, when we go get our car repaired, we sit there and we listen to the words of the mechanic like a doctor telling us whether we got cancer or not, because we know it's going to be expensive. But, boy, how they present that information will really communicate how you perceive that information. So when they're sitting there and they're telling you, oh, boy, whew, this thing is going to be ruthless. I don't know how much you're going to afford it. All of a sudden, your mind wraps around the words of how the mechanic communicates to you how much it's going to cost you to get your car repaired. Now, take this across the street to a different mechanic, and the mechanic looks at you and says, you know, I know you got a lot of miles in your car, but you've got a good, good car. And from looking at it and some of the parts and so forth, the only thing you really need is a new transmission. Now, it's going to be a little expensive, but the investment in getting a new transmission means that you won't have to buy another car anytime soon, and you may actually save your money. You'll get another 100,000, 200,000 miles out of this car. Now, all of a sudden, your whole view and perspective about getting the transmission changes from someone who has talked to you about, oh, boy, it's really going to stink, to kick out all this money for a car to now looking at it as a smart investment, all in one fell swoop. Just like that, a few words communicated to you in such a manner, let me say this again, a few words communicated to you in such a manner has literally shifted how you perceive the action of having your car car transmission replaced. Just like that. And think about it. One of the things that people fail to realize is that almost any capacity that you have, whether it be job, church, community service, and so forth, your words are your mechanism for power and effect. Think about it. Your words is your power and mechanism for effect. Think about it. If you're a teacher, the words that are conveyed to the student will empower that student's knowledge. If you're a doctor, your ability to communicate what needs to be done to effectively take care of your health. If you're a dentist, same thing with your teeth. Mechanic, your car. You know, heck, if you go to the post office and somebody tells you that the rate of postage goes up, that's going to have some impact on you as a whole. I can tell you, all in one fell swoop, that one of the things that I thought was very powerful about the book that she wrote, the author wrote, she's going to be here very shortly, is getting a full appreciation of the fact. Let me throw this out again. Getting a full appreciation of the fact that a lot of times we underestimate how words can change and impact us at a moment's notice. Literally, a moment's notice. But I'm not going to waste your time because I'll run my mouth all day. You know how I get down. So let me take the opportunity to share with you some brief background information. Our guest this evening is a graduate of, I know I'm going to mess this up because I'm from Arkansas and I mess up stuff all the time, Swarthmore College, and cum laude graduate of Rutgers School of Law from Camden. She practiced law in Atlantic City, New Jersey for 22 years. She is a powerful word sculptor who knows how to transform the stress of daily living into peace. Have a Zen moment with me, ladies and gentlemen, and it is my honor and pleasure to have with you attorney and author Janet Smith Warfield. Janet, you there with us this evening?
I certainly am. Hi, how are you, Anthony?
Doing wonderful. How are you doing this evening?
I am doing terrific. Thank you. You've been doing a lot of traveling, but I'm doing fine.
Well, I'm glad we were able to get you in one spot, and I want to say a special thanks to Sherry Hughes for making this interview possible and also providing me a copy of your book, and the title of her book, of course, is Shift, Change Your Words, Change Your World. And first of all, let me applaud you for this awesome book that you wrote. And I was, you know, it's so funny, as I was reading through it, I was getting different points that were jumping in my mind all over the place. And I was like, man.
That's what it's supposed to do. I'm glad to hear that.
No, I'm going to be embarrassed because I'm going to jump all over the place, so please forgive me. Because I read this one chapter, and it made me think about something that I talked to. And, gosh, if I had my hand on the chapter, forgive me, I'm usually a little bit more organized. But this book really opened my mind up to a variety of different things. You wrote in a chapter about 9/11 when you were working in your firm, and you had two paralegals working with you.
Yeah.
And I remember I told students, I teach as well, and I always comment to students that everybody can always tell you what they were doing when 9/11 happened. They may not be able to pinpoint any other point in their lives, but they can tell you exactly what was going on in 9/11.
That's an interesting comment. That's an interesting comment. And, yes, I certainly remember because the energy in that law office just changed in a nanosecond. We had a wonderful, harmonious office most of the time. I had two wonderful paralegals. We all worked together very well. And then on the morning of 9/11, the phone started ringing. And it was brothers, sisters, kids calling my paralegals and giving them a graphic detail moment by moment of everything they were seeing on the TV. And the energy in that office changed in a nanosecond. There was nothing any of us could do at that point. But the words coming through the phone were terrorizing my paralegals. Because I've worked a lot with fear, they weren't terrorizing me, and I think if there was something I could do, I'd do it in a minute. There was nothing I could do. Let's get on with doing the things that we can do. And I couldn't help but think, if we had been instead in a 19th century office with no telephones, no computers, our office would have continued to be that harmonious space that we were all used to working in.
And it's frightening, because when I was reading that and I kept thinking, I said, you know, it's amazing. Had I not turned on the TV that day, I probably, you know, and just not paid attention to the phone, I may not have known about that for a couple of days, easily.
That's right. That's right.
But literally, the
world.
You
would have gone on with your life and with your work, and there was probably nothing you could do either to prevent those planes from crashing into the World Trade Center. So,
you know,
yeah, go ahead.
No. It is funny, and I'm going to tell you, I'm probably going to use your book when I'm teaching my class, so don't feel bad.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, good.
Because one of the things that I teach a class on, and on Homeland Security, and one of the things that I focus on is I talk about terrorism, and one of the things I lead into with students is I tell them, at the end of the day, you're not going to want to hear this, but there's nothing different between you and a terrorist. And of course, that usually gets a lot of students fired up, and it has nothing to do with their actions as much as it is what drives their actions. And because I noticed that one of the points that you made in your book, maybe that was just my taking from it, is that you make a point of indicating that words and situations can be seen, the exact same set of facts can be seen a variety of different ways.
And I'm sure you know that from the law of practice.
Of course. But I'm always curious is, how do you communicate to people that they have a choice in how they interpret those circumstances?
The analogy I use all the time when I do workshops is I work with optical illusions, because it's such a good analogy to the real world. If you look at an optical illusion, the most common one being the old hag and the young woman. Are you familiar with that one?
I surely am.
Okay. Well, the lines on the paper do not change. Nothing in front of you changes. But your mind will take those lines and either shape them to see a young woman or an old hag. If you see the young woman, you are probably then attaching words to what you see, like young, beautiful, vibrant, enthusiastic, charming, whatever. If you see the old hag, maybe she actually makes you feel kind of depressed, because you're thinking, oh, this woman's old, she's ugly, she's got this big chin, she's got this pencil-thin mouth, she's got drooping eyelids. And maybe it makes you start thinking about your own death, your own physical death, and your own decline. So depending on what you see, your emotions are going to be very different. And depending on what your emotions are, you may choose different actions. Your question pertained to how do you make people realize they have a choice. I think when they look at an optical illusion, for example, which is what I start with, they can see, once they can see both images, and their perception just flips back and forth between the two images, they can choose which one they want to focus on. And if you take that analogy and carry it over into the real world, it's the same thing. We can choose the thoughts that will make us feel peaceful, calm, in control of our lives, or we can focus on things that are going to make us feel totally victimized, out of control, fearful, all that stuff that none of us really wants to pull into our lives. Doesn't mean that you don't have challenges from out there. You do. But the point is, how are you going to shape those challenges? How do you want to feel in response to them? And what actions are you going to take? And if I can just give, I did another radio interview this morning, but I've been thinking about it since
no problem.
We talked. And a good example, I think, is the emotion of anger. If I am thinking about anger as something that I don't want to allow in my life, I shouldn't be angry, then I'm distancing myself from the anger, but it may come out in a lot of ways that I don't expect because I'm trying to control it. If, on the other hand, I experience anger and I look at it and I see it as a messenger to me that is saying, Janet, there are some things in your life that you need to change to bring yourself into balance and this angry relationship into balance, then I can start putting all my effort where my power is, which is on myself, and I can try to decipher the message. The message with anger frequently is learning one of two things, either to set boundaries with somebody, set limits, and say, no, I'm not willing to play your game on this. If you have to, you walk away from a relationship. The other thing with anger, and I just lost my train of thought here for a minute. It can help you clarify your own values. It can really help you clarify what matters to you. For example, if you are angry over the injustice you see in the world, it doesn't mean you take your anger and you start calling other people names or blaming them or bombing them or verbally abusing them or hitting them or any of that stuff. But what it is telling you about your values is that justice is a very important thing to you, and then you can put all your effort into promoting justice as opposed to fighting injustice. And it's a whole different energy to being motivated to ensure that we have just legal systems, for example, or just treatment of all citizens regardless of race, color, creed, etc. So it's a totally different focus. You're using the anger to clarify what matters to you, and it may even give you your reason for being on this planet.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was reading through your book, and I got, and please help me on make sure that I'm on the right track, because when I was reading your book, I got the impression that you were trying to drive home the importance of letting go of predestined and predefined responses to various situations and to allow your brain to open up to the infinite possibilities that other courses can be taken, even more so, more positive courses that can be taken.
That certainly is one of the messages of the books. Every single one of us is conditioned in some way from the day we were born. The day we came out of the womb, our parents started teaching us what was right and wrong and good and bad, and they started structuring our lives for us. Now, this isn't necessarily bad. A lot of it gave us a lot of stability and perhaps a lot of direction in life. But then we assume that what we've been taught is true, and it is not necessarily true. There are many different ways of shaping our lives. What we've been taught is one way, and if it works for us and everybody around us, that's fine. If it's not working, then we can start exploring other ways of shaping what's out there so that it will work for both us and the people with whom we're in relationship. In other words, if we end up with a win-win-win solution as opposed to fighting each other.
But Janet, doesn't that go against the normal dogma of how our society is raised? You know, that we have, aren't we a convenient-based society where it's convenient to have predefined answers to almost every situation where you're supposed to go to high school and you're supposed to go to college after you're done? You know, and then if you don't do anything other than that, you know, you're off kilter. Aren't we a society of convenience where it's safer and more convenient for us to hold on to these predefined or preordained messages that have been communicated to us as gospel?
Oh, sure. It's much safer up to a point until it no longer works for you in whatever respect. For example, I've spoken with people whose fathers drummed into them that artists don't make any money. The kid loved to paint, and his father said, you don't want to become an artist. There's no money in that. You need to go to college and become an engineer. The guy spent a good bit of his life being miserable. Now, if he followed his father's direction, and he was actually very happy being an engineer, and maybe it's something that fit him very well, then that direction would have been helpful. But it's kind of this constant dance of consciousness we're all in. And the point is, each of us can choose our own thoughts, our own emotions, our own actions. And the only caveat I would add to that is it has to be a choice that will not harm either you or anybody else. And that's an overgeneralization too, but it's a really good starting point, I think. It means do whatever you want as long as you aren't hurting either yourself or somebody else.
20 after the hour here on In the Know with Tony Reeves. I have the distinct honor and pleasure of having attorney and author Janet Smith Warfield, who is talking to us about her book, Shift, Change Your Words, Change Your World. We'll give her the opportunity to let us know where we can find that book in a little bit, but having a good dialogue here. But if you want to call in, the number is, of course, 718-508-9431. Again, 718-508-9431. I actually laughed at one of your chapters. Because,
which one?
Well, it was chapter 14. And the reason why I laughed is, and please allow me the opportunity to share, that for those of you who haven't read the book, the chapter is called Predestination and Free Will. And when I read the first story, I infinitely thought of a scenario when I used to work at a law firm several years ago. It was a firm where it was literally, in the office, satellite office I worked in, there were two men, myself and another partner, and the rest were all women. And we left that night, and the ladies came behind us, three young ladies. They were all robbed by the same guy at the same time. I didn't think that was possible. But the guy was on a bike. As soon as they separated, he ran to one, grabbed her purse. She froze. And the young lady saw him coming. One young lady saw him coming after he did that. She took off running. And then the third young lady, he came to grab her purse. She fought him back because all she thought about was, my child, you're a single mom, my child stuff is in here. If he takes it, it'll take me forever to replace it. Her safety went completely out the window. It was more about preserving her child's things. And someone asked me which one was the right course of action. And I told them all three. And they just gave me this look, like, what do you mean by all three? That can't be right. I'm like, well, only and as I was reading not only chapter 14, one of the things that I noticed in your book, especially when you were talking about good and evil and God and the devil, is it's almost on this notion that we're hung up on wanting to define something into clearly defined categories. It's like we've got to have a clearly defined answer for every particular action. But some of us have a hard time breaking out of that because that's what we're used to thinking. That's what we've been told that we're supposed to think.
I know.
And now I'm going to tell you, your chapter on science and the religion, I'm a biology major by trade. So needless to say, I read that. I was like, okay. I had to read a little slower when you were talking about that. I said, okay, I'm a science major, so I hope she's not going to stab me here. The problem I always, when I was reading it, is for some people, probably like myself being a science major, there's some comfort in looking for a clearly defined answer and thinking and believing that there's one out there.
I absolutely have to do that for myself. The danger is trying to make my answer right for you, who has the scientific background and the scientific training. And a lot depends on the purpose for which you want to use those tools or those vehicles. Science has a wonderful set of tools for improving our physical life, as long as they are used to improve it instead of bombing Hiroshima, something like that. A lot depends on how they are used. But, yeah, I agree. Math and science are absolutely wonderful tools, and they work very well in the physical world. They are not wonderful tools when you're dealing with what has loosely been called spirituality or religion, which really deal more with helping us emotionally and helping us in our relationships and helping us make life work somehow and make ethical choices, things like that. You're dealing with totally different end products, so to speak, and different tools work differently depending on what it is you want to do. If you want to screw in a nail, you use a screwdriver. You don't use a hammer. So science works wonderfully for some things.
Now, you got two things I read in here. One, I was having a hard time grappling, and it might have been my science brain. So help me with this a little bit. And as you were explaining it in your book, I was getting a little bit of a grasp, but I want you to explain to it. You refer to the non-dual consciousness?
Yes.
Please explain what that actually means.
Let me just ask you a question or give you an example instead and see if this gives you some kind of an idea of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
I don't know where you are right now, but look right in front of you.
Okay.
And then answer this question without using words. What do you see?
Okay.
Can you do that?
Without using words? I could probably do it with hand signals, but it would take a while.
Well, without using hand signals, without using words, what do you see? And I could follow it up with other questions. Without using words or hand signals or anything else, what do you hear? Without using words, what do you feel? You can go through the whole set of senses. Now, being trained in sciences, I am sure you want to chop up what you see in front of you, and you want to put word labels on it. Am I right?
That's right. That's correct.
Well, you see, that's the dual consciousness. And I don't care how you chop it up. It's still dual consciousness. When you can be in the moment and you can simply experience in silence everything that's around. A good example might be if you are out on a lake at sunset, have you ever felt just totally immersed in the beauty?
Well, of course.
That would be a moment of non-dual consciousness where you aren't even thinking, your head isn't working, it's just, oh my gosh, this is unbelievably spectacular, and I'm part of it.
Hmm.
So I can try to point you in the direction of what I mean by those examples, but if you haven't actually experienced it, you probably won't know what I mean, and if you have, you'll know in a minute. As I say, in that chapter, I had quite a long conversation, actually, email conversation with a newfound friend who had actually helped put together some of the NASA experiments. She was trained as a biologist, I believe, and as a scientist. And yet she had experienced this non-dual consciousness. She described it as a gray featureless space. Those are words.
Mm-hmm.
But they point. They point to what it is. And you'll never, you see, the problem with even dealing with this subject matter is that you're trying to use words to describe an experience which is unifying and holistic, which is not divided. Words, by their nature, separate and divide, always. So it's like trying to use a screwdriver to hammer in a nail.
Mm-hmm.
The tool that you're using to describe this particular, it is a consciousness shift. It's suddenly seeing the world differently. And words don't work. They can point.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can use lots of different words to point to it or sort of describe it. It would be as if six people were in the same garden, but one was really fascinated with roses and one loved the chrysanthemums, one loved the climbing vines, one was interested in the benches and the trellises, another was interested in the flagstone walk. If each of those people were to describe that very same scene, they would all be using different words.
Mm-hmm.
And each one would be focusing on a part of that. And you, if you were just listening to the words, you'd probably think they were talking about totally different things.
Hmm. Okay. And I will tell you, I have to applaud you because, and this is just me, the martial arts side of me coming out, because a lot of the things when I was reading, the first person that came to my mind, as silly as it may seem, was Bruce Lee. That was the first person that popped into my mind.
I'm sorry, who was it?
Bruce Lee.
I don't know Bruce Lee, I'm sorry.
Bruce Lee,
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Bruce Lee, he's got a book called The Warrior Within. And
okay.
He's probably best known, if you ask anybody who's into karate and everything, they'll tell you about his movie Enter the Dragon. And one of the things that he's known for is he was a philosophy major.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his biggest teachings was he always said, be like water, because he said water is formless. It basically takes the form of whatever shape it's in. It can destroy rocks or it can flow. Just be like water. And so when I was reading your book, the one thing I noticed, and for those of you who, again, we're talking about shift, change your words, change your world, by Janet Smith Warfield, who's with us this evening. Probably the chapter that jumped out the most at me, that was reflective of a lot of the teachings that I've read in his books and other books like, you know, Sun Tzu and Miyamoto Musashi, different ones that I've read that deals with strategy and tactics and so forth. I loved part three. Because part three looks, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but a good part of part three looks like you were focusing on definitive endpoint or definitive perceived starting points and endpoints. And that's the way, and I was marveled at why you took that approach to attack those things. And when you were talking about heaven and hell, falsehood, truth, devil and God, even the end and beginning, I was like, that's a different approach. What was your focus when you were attacking certain things that people perceive as being endpoints?
Ooh. I don't know that I was really attacking it. My own personal struggle on this was, how do I synthesize these concepts, these words that appear to be opposites? But as soon as you understand them in context, they are not opposites, just like the example you just gave of the three women being robbed. Was there a predestination going on there, in that they were all predestined to be robbed? Or was there free will because each one of them chose a different response to being robbed? It's the same stuff going on out there, but depending on what aspect of it you focus on, you could say, well, of course there was predestination, or of course there was free will. But if you look at it in context, there was both, in a sense, predestination and free will.
Okay.
So for my own personal challenge and struggle was just, how do I synthesize these words that appear to be opposite? And I know from this experience, this consciousness shifting experience I had, that they are not. They are simply words that focus on different aspects of an experience.
Now, I must talk about, and for those of you, again, we're talking with Ms. Janet Smith Warfield about her book, Shift, Change Your Worlds, and Change Your Words, Change Your World. Dynamic books. I encourage you to take the opportunity to read it. Explain to me the scenario with the guy that was going off on you at your door. When
yeah.
You said that he was just mad. I don't know. I didn't really get a gleam in this. What was he so angry about, or did it even matter at that particular point? How were you able to just diffuse that situation? And it appears as if you didn't do a whole lot of action to diffuse it. It kind of diffused itself.
No, the chronology in the book is the reverse of the way it really happened. My first playing with these different ideas was my son's bedwetting. And again, none of this at the time was making any sense to me, but I was in a desperate situation. The man at the door, just to specifically answer your question, I don't remember. I truly don't remember anything except the anger. And I simply chose at that point to respond differently to the anger because I was seeing a different response working in other areas of my life. And I didn't begin to understand what was happening, but I was simply following a model that had been given to me by A.S. Neal initially, where when he had problem children, we'll use that, put that in quotes, difficult, challenging children in his English boarding school, instead of punishing them, spanking them, explaining to them why they shouldn't do what they were doing, he just gave them a penny. And I'm thinking, he did what? Why should you reward a child for bad behavior? This is the traditional thinking that we've all been taught. Or, you know, why the heck would you expect that to work? But I was also in a very desperate situation with my son where everything that society had taught me was not working to stop this bedwetting by this five-year-old. So I was so desperate, and I knew I was getting out of control, too, and I didn't like being out of control in this relationship. I was willing to try something that made no sense to me. It was totally different from everything I'd been taught, but I was willing to give it a try to see what would happen. And what happened was, of course, when I gave Bill a penny after he wet the bed, he never wet the bed again.
And I read that, and I was waiting for the follow-up after when you read that. I wrote that. I'm like, okay, that was it? You just gave a penny and he stopped?
Yeah. I mean, it totally blew my mind, and then I could not stop thinking about it because it was so much easier than the sitting down and talking to him or raising my voice with him or spanking him. I just gave him a penny, and it was fine. And the same with the man at the door. He came at me extremely angry, and instead of defending myself or getting angry back or trying to explain to him why I'd done what I'd done, I didn't do any of that. I just said, you know, I'm really sorry. What can I do to help? Or what can I do to make this better? The anger stopped. And I'm watching this. It makes no sense. It's totally contrary to everything I've ever been taught, and it works.
Well, I want you, one of the things that you mentioned about was talks about lack of knowledge and the fear that comes along with that lack of knowledge. And one of the things that I've heard people, especially motivational speakers and persons and so forth, who always talk about is probably one of the greatest fears is the fear of the unknown. It's like that filler. Like, and I like the way you refer to it, like when you have a lack of knowledge, the filler is that fear. Sometimes people have a hard time reevaluating or readjusting their mindset to look at that which they fear as a positive thing.
Yeah.
How do you expand to that level of consciousness where you can view something that you should be, that you're told yourself you should be afraid of as something that may be a positive thing?
This probably doesn't precisely answer your question, but let me go off on a little different tack here.
No problem.
I have struggled with fear my entire life. I have struggled with terror at times. And frankly, the idea for me of just putting some of these ideas out in public has been a very frightening experience. And I've had to work with that fear and that terror. There, whenever I'm feeling fear, I know now my mind is focused on one of two things, or often on both. First of all, it's focused in the future. What if this happens 10 years from now? What if this happens tomorrow? I'm never in the present moment. My head is out in the future. And the other place where my head is on what somebody else may think, do, or say. And as soon as my mind is in one of those two places, I am giving all my present personal power away. The antidote is to consciously make a choice to bring my mind back to the present moment and simply ask myself, now, what is my next step? What is my next choice here? That's always manageable. I may not be able to see into the entire future. I can't. And none of us can. A lot of the things we worry about never happen. But I can always manage that present moment. And if I truly am in a dangerous situation that where I ought to be afraid, I won't have time to think about it. I will just respond or react instinctively, just as the woman you were talking about who fought to keep her pocketbook. That was instinctive. And she was not afraid. She wasn't even thinking about fear. She wasn't walking down the street thinking, oh, my gosh, I wonder if there's a man out there who 10 minutes from now is going to jump out at me and rob me. She wasn't thinking that. It happened. She responded. She knew what she had to do to protect herself, and she did it. So the point is, when you're feeling fear, just notice where your mind is. And then you've got a choice. You can leave it out there, and, you know, you can focus on what somebody else might do or what they might think if you do something. Or you can bring it back to where you are right now. And the present is your point of personal power.
And I like the fact that you keep mentioning about giving your power away. And the way you communicate it, I never would have thought about it. I like the fact that you communicated that you're looking into the beyond. And I think that's probably where a lot of people, including myself, have a habit, is that we get so mystified by that which we don't know that it almost overwhelms us to the point of preventing us from doing something today for fear of what we believe is going to happen tomorrow.
Or might happen, yeah. And we do give our power away. When you bring your mind back to the present moment, which is all we truly have that we can take action on, then you can start thinking about what matters to me in this life. What would I like to see changed in this world? And how can I bring that about? And then you are focused on a very positive, personal personal path, the reason you're on this planet, your own mission. And that's empowering. And it doesn't mean it's a smooth path. It's not. You will run into roadblocks. But your analogy of being like water and flowing around, I mean, I could tell you some amazing stories where I have done just that, not without a lot of turmoil within me first, but eventually I have just allowed the other person to have their way. And the Eastern religions talk about karma. You should see what they bring into their lives. It's just amazing. Just a real fast example down in Panama where I live, my first landlord, we had an agreement when I moved in. I was a darn good tenant. I paid my rent on time and I took care of the place. And he had agreed that I could stay there until my home was built. Well, after 2 years, he found somebody else who would pay more money and give him a longer-term lease. And he said to me, can you meet this? I'm sure you understand I have business decisions to make. And I said, you know, no, I can't make that commitment. I can't make a 3-year commitment. The more money I would have been willing to do for a short period of time. So the bottom line was, under Panama law, he could evict me. He could arbitrarily throw me out regardless of what our lease said. So I left, not happily at all. In fact, initially with a lot of anger, and then I just gave it up, and I figured, I don't have any choice. I moved out. Well, he had broken his promise to me. His new tenant then broke their promise to him, and that house sat unoccupied, unrented, with no money coming into him for about a year and a half.
Ow. Wow.
So by my going along with what he was demanding, I was actually allowing the universe to work without my having to take any action other than giving him what he wanted.
And I note that you use a couple of examples. That's interesting because you talked about religious in your chapter in your book, but you also gave some religious examples, like when in addition to talking about Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, you made reference, and I think the one that jumped at me was, of course, the reference with regards to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that one of the things I note from a couple of different experiences is how powerful inaction can be. I think we're of a society that we believe you got to take action anytime a situation presents itself. But you named a number of different situations where doing nothing was just as powerful as doing something.
Sometimes it's much more powerful. And again, it's a conscious choice as to whether to take action or whether not to take action. And it is a choice not to take action. So there's a sense in which it is active in that it's a conscious choice. Does that make any sense?
It does. It does. But it's interesting because we're in a society that, you know, if somebody gets in your face, you're supposed to get in their face back. If somebody hits you, you got to hit them back. If somebody does something like in your scenario you just talked about with the landlord, you know, you know how we're, as an attorney, you can definitely understand how litigious people can be. We feel like if somebody does something to us, they must pay, and we must do something to be the facilitation of that pain. And I'm just fascinated when I was reading here just how you kind of communicated that if you look at a situation just from its totality without overanalyzing, you can, the universe could actually resolve the situation without you having to do something.
And in that particular example, let me make it clear that I went as far as I possibly could within the bounds of the law and the Panamanian culture to stay in that house because I was angry. He had betrayed my trust. He had broken a promise to me. He had not been accountable and followed through with what he had said he would do, and I was very angry. But after I had exhausted every possibility I had for staying there, I left. And I left as fast as I could because I didn't want to pay him any more rent than I would have to.
Now, you spoke a lot about, and that's one thing that I noticed when reading here, you spoke a lot about anger and that particular emotion and how you can take certain actions to process that energy in such a way that it won't be detrimental to you. What is a starting point? What is a good starting point for a person who is not used to channeling their anger in a way that could lead to a more overall positive outcome?
Well, probably, certainly, pull back a little bit from the anger and just watch it, if you can do that. Often, I think someone who just reacts in anger is not thinking consciously at all. They're just doing what they've been trained to do their entire lives, and it doesn't really work very well for them. They probably end up with a lot of bloody noses, and maybe they like that. But if they want to change that, with anger, I think it's absolutely necessary to recognize it. For me, when I feel anger, I've got to notice it's there because it's telling me there is something I need to change in my life. So if I can step back from it, notice it, embrace it, it's a messenger. What's the message it's giving me? For me, it's usually setting boundaries with somebody who's trampling all over me, or else it's becoming more assertive with that type of person. Or sometimes it's walking out of a relationship and saying, no, I'm not going to give energy to this. If you want to go scream and yell and punch somebody, go pick on somebody else because I'm not going to participate in that. And you know, I can give you so many examples of this, too. A really good lesson that a former judge with whom I worked taught me when I was a new attorney in practice. I was working for a senior male attorney in a large law firm in Atlantic City. And this guy was running me ragged. He would send me off on one project, and then I'd get that done, and then he'd change his mind, and he'd want something else. And you know how long it takes to do legal research. Maybe not as long now as it used to take. But I was working probably 80 hours a week. I had no time to myself. And it always felt as if I was running around in circles and not really accomplishing anything because he kept changing his mind about what he wanted. Well, I was feeling a lot of anger toward this attorney and happened to meet my judge friend at one of the Bar Association social meetings and started ranting and raving about this guy I was working for. The judge, he looked at me, he turned his back, and he walked away. And he was a man I fully respected. But as soon as he walked away, I had no audience. So there was no point in my continuing the rant. And it also made me stop and look at my own conduct and think, you know, that wasn't such a sharp thing to do, Janet.
Wow. Okay. So his simple action, that's, and I'm assuming that he never brought it up for discussion ever again, did he?
He didn't want to talk about it. I mean, I was wasting his time, frankly. I wanted sympathy and I wanted an audience, and what I really needed to do, which I did a few months later, was quit that job and move on.
And I will tell you, the one thing that I have to admit from, and you said you quit the job, you moved on and so forth, and him walking away, there was a couple of examples that I noticed and so forth that sometimes sometimes the answer itself is right there in front of you, but sometimes I believe that we spend a lot of time wanting to embrace that necessary action we have to take. Like, that becomes a little bit more important. Like, with the guy who was at the door arguing with you, you could have easily, well, he was doing arguing. I think he was just mad. You were just kind of standing there. You could have easily got into a verbal argument that probably would have lasted for a good while.
And we would have ended up enemies, with neither of us winning.
Like you, and I noticed it, like in the book, you made a point about, and gosh, I almost hate the fact that we're almost out of time, because the examples you were giving were so unique. Like the example of the two boys who wanted to fight each other, and I think a teacher separated them and asked each one of them, do you want to fight? And they basically said, no, I don't want to fight, but he's making me do it. And I'm thinking, and as I'm reading it, and then I guess after talking with each one of them and kind of seeing what they wanted to do, after a while, 2 minutes later, they were out there playing again.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I was just amazed. It was amazing how that little scenario right there, they were so quick to want to use their energy to generate it towards each other in a negative fashion, that once you separated them, kind of identified what was going on, it just dissipated.
Yeah.
Just that quick.
Because I refocused their attention not from what the other kid was doing to hurt them, but what they wanted to do. And that was all. So do you want to fight? No, I don't. But he's making me do it. Well, if you want to fight, go ahead and fight. Well, no, I don't want to fight.
And it was amazing, and I want to applaud you, because I was reading that, and it was amazing. All in one swoop, energy was diffused. Just that quick.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what words can do once you train yourself in them and you become skilled in using them. I can tell a huge amount about a person I'm talking to just by the way they... I'll embarrass everybody. Nobody will want to talk to me, but I truly, just by listening to the words that they use, if they do a lot of gossip or they're blaming somebody else, complaining and blaming somebody else, right away I know there's a lot they need to learn and change. Now, I may not tell them that, but I may ask them some questions, hopefully to refocus a lot of what they're thinking and doing. Like, well, you know, how do you think you could turn that around? That puts the power back in their hands.
Okay.
And gets the focus off of blaming the other person.
Well, we've got about one more minute, and so I want and like I said, I felt back. I'm telling you, as I was reading your book, instinctively I was comparing it to a lot of the things that I've other books I've read, and just, I could probably go on for a while, but I want to make sure I give people the opportunity, if they want to get their hands on this great book, where can they go?
Well, they can certainly go to my website, which is Word Sculptures, WordSculptures.com. I also have a blog at JanetSmithWarfield.com.
Nice.
Or they can buy it. I'm sorry?
Well, I said very nice.
Oh, and they can also get it on Amazon. So any of those options. And local bookstores, some libraries in the United States have it, and local bookstores in certain areas of the country have it. For example, Changing Hands Bookstore out in Phoenix has my book now. Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe has it. There are some bookstores, and you can always ask your bookstore to order it if you want to go that route.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the opportunity for joining us this evening. I was informed that you have been traveling quite a bit, and so I'm very appreciative that I had the opportunity to get you on, because I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to based on all of your traveling, but I feel blessed and honored to have had you on this evening.
Well, thank you so much. And I appreciated a lot of your examples and comments, too, because they illustrated the points I'm trying to make in different ways, which is always good.
Okay. Well, you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and I look forward to your next book.
Well, thank you so much. It'll probably be on word illusions.
Well, I wish you the very best. Stay safe for the holidays, and if you ever want to come back, we definitely would love to have you.
Well, thank you so much. I would love to do that. Maybe we'll do that sometime.
Definitely.
Okay, you have a good night.
You too. Take care.
Bye. Bye.
And for those of you who didn't have the opportunity or you're just coming on late, I'm going to go ahead and tell you this. I encourage you to take the opportunity to go to JanetSmithWarfield.com, check out her blog, check out her information. More importantly, get this book. I mean, really, get this book. I'll be the first to tell you that I love reading books on philosophy. I love reading books on strategy and tactics and so forth. And when I read this book, instinctively, I drew from a lot of the different types of readings that I'd had before. And I love the vantage points. And there is a chapter that talks about the beginning and the end, and it talks about a circle. And it was fascinating because I was looking at it as he says, you know, if there's a beginning and an end, what's the beginning, what's the end? And all I kept thinking was, you know, it's almost like what came first, the chicken or the egg? And sometimes as I was reading it, all I kept thinking was, you know what? I think in our society we think in terms of finite beginnings and finite endings because it is easier. We think in terms of finite circumstances with finite responses, meaning when this happens, you must do this. When this happens, you must do that. Anytime you drive us to come out of that comfort zone, you push us into unfamiliar territory, which, of course, instinctively brings forth that fear. You know, you're supposed to do these things so that if you're not able to do these things, what do you do next? You know, you look at a person, and this is going to be an aside, like a Wayman Tinsdale, jamming basketball player. Awesome basketball player, but you know he started experiencing significant health problems. I think he lost part of his leg from the knee down. So you're thinking he could have easily folded up and said, "Oh my gosh, my career is over, my life's over, I don't have sports." The man went on to a great second career. He's an awesome example of a great second career. He became a bassist. Janet Smith Warfield, she worked as an attorney for 20 plus years, and effectively, and probably while she was practicing, transitioned from that to successful author. Motivational speaker, and mind sculptor. And you would say to yourself, how does she make that evolution? Well, she made that evolution, the next evolution, because she did not allow herself to be limited within the predefined scope of a predefined set of circumstances. You know, a lot of times we believe in our minds, and I think society even as a whole takes this mantra, grow up, go to school, go to college, get a job, get married, retire, die. And really, everything in between is just little, you know, hopscotch spots along the way. But I'm telling you, if you want a book that's going to challenge you to expand your mindset and to look at things from a much different perspective and how you can maximize those experiences and look at things that you may have viewed from a negative standpoint or even a dark standpoint, whatever phrases that you use that connotates that, I'm going to encourage you, by all means, take the time. Let me repeat this again. Take the time to purchase this book. You're going to find that the information that she provides in here will provide you with a very unique perspective, one that you will embrace and one that you will definitely take a lot from. All right, everybody. Woo! This has been a rock'em sock'em day. But as always, I want to say thank you very much for you taking the time to be with me this evening. Again, I want to encourage you to make sure that you have a safe holiday season. A lot of crazy things can happen out there. Crazy traveler, crazy drivers, crazy rides, whatever the case may be. But be safe. Get to your destinations. Enjoy the holidays. More importantly, get right back here on Monday. You rocking and jocking on the best damn morning show with a legal twist. Legal Beat in the Morning. Have a happy holidays.